The head of World Motor Racing, Max Mosley, has won his privacy action against the News of the World. The judge awarded him damages of £60,000.
It demonstrates that their Nazi lie was completely invented and had no justification. It also shows that they had no right to go into private premises and take pictures and films of adults engaged in activities which are no one's business but those of the people concerned.
Max Mosley speaking immediately after his successful privacy action against the News of the World last year. But if you thought that was the end of the matter, you really couldn't be more mistaken. Mr. Mosley's told us that he's pursuing multiple legal actions across Europe with a view to fundamentally changing the law in the UK. This would mean that journalists who don't inform people when they're planning to publish a story about their private life could go to jail. If he wins, it could herald a massive change to our law and force Parliament to legislate. That's something Mr. Mosley dearly wants. So today we're devoting the entire programme to the changing face of our privacy law. We speak in detail to Max Mosley, but we begin with the editor of Private Eye, Ian Hislop, who knows exactly where he stands.
The problem with Mosley's case is he would like to make a general principle out of what happened to him. Now, as far as I can see, what happened to him, the law, as everyone expected, supported him. He won. He now wants to change the law to make it more punitive. I mean, bad law is always advanced by a case like Mosley's that seems on the surface of it to have some merit, and then is extended to all the people who don't have any merit and then just want to cover up what they're doing. So yes, it's bad news for journalism, and it may be embarrassing that the case is the worst type of red-top drivel, but that's not the point.
An implacably opposed Ian Hislop, illustrating that the battle between those who regard Max Mosley as a threat to press freedom and those who see him as a protector of the right to privacy is well and truly on. Today's programme touches upon adult sexual matters. You'll probably recall that the case itself centred on allegations by the News of the World and repeated by newspapers across Europe that Mr. Mosley, the son of the fascist leader Sir Oswald Mosley, took part in a Nazi-style sadomasochistic orgy with five women. When I spoke to him at his home in London, I asked him what kind of privacy law he'd like to see MPs enact here.
They should simply follow the continent. I mean, for example, in France, if you take pictures of somebody in a private place without their consent, you can go to prison for a year. If you publish pictures taken under those circumstances, you can also go to prison for a year. That's the provision under which we are trying to pursue the News of the World in France. I think that's absolutely right.
Do you accept that, much as you would like to see Parliament legislate, it simply isn't going to happen, because as soon as parliamentarians get their teeth stuck into all this, people are going to say, well, you know, politicians, they're the very hypocrites who should be exposed, and here they are creating a law that's going to protect themselves.
I think you'll get a campaign of that kind from the press, and that's why it's necessary to go to Strasbourg, because if there's a judgment in Strasbourg, then the United Kingdom is bound to follow that judgment and introduce the legislation. That's why it feels very funny, but the case is Mosley versus the United Kingdom.
So it's Mosley versus the UK. But his case is just the latest of a line which have created a de facto privacy law. Others have famously featured photographs of Michael Douglas and Catherine Zeta-Jones' wedding, and Naomi Campbell leaving drug addiction treatment. The courts have been tasked with balancing the individual's right to privacy under Article 8 of the Human Rights Act against the media's right to freedom of expression under Article 10. Amalie De Silva is a partner at Wiggin LLP, a specialist media law firm. She believes that even without new legislation, the parameters of what's now permissible under case law have changed significantly.
The press are certainly aware that it is a very risky proposition to publish certain types of stories, and particularly the more celebrity-oriented ones. And in my experience, there may well be stories which 5 years ago they may have gone ahead and published, and now they're thinking, well, you know, not quite so sure about it.
Journalists like Ian Hislop say the law's operating rather more insidiously than that.
If you want to reveal something that someone doesn't want, they now no longer claim libel, and they just say this is privacy, and we'll have an injunction, please. And then we'll extend the privacy law so that not only will we have the injunction, but we'll have another injunction that says you can't mention the injunction. And if you try and challenge that, then we'll appeal, and then you will never get this story into the public arena. we will have silence, censorship by extended judicial process.
Is that really happening?
Twice last week. Yes, it is happening.
What do they seek to shroud in the cloak of privacy?
Well, obviously I can't tell you anything because of this privacy law. They get wind of the fact that you want to write a story about them, because if you put the facts to them, something Mr. Mosley is very keen on, I mean, in fact, wants to imprison us all if we don't, if you put the facts to them, they then say, oh, I'll have an injunction then on the grounds of privacy. That's the end of the story.
Max Mosley's case goes to the heart of the way the press operate. I began by asking him what he believes should be covered by privacy.
I think that it's most people recognise that there are some human activities that people prefer to do in private. But where it gets interesting as far as the law is concerned is that then there's an attempt to balance the desire of the individual to keep it private with the public interest, which is the Article 10 part of the Human Rights Act, where if the public has an interest, then it should be possible for this to be published. Well, of course, sex in itself, if it's to be private, you have to put in one pan the person's desire to be private, the embarrassment to him, the embarrassment to his family, the inherent right to conduct your life as you wish. And in the other pan, you have to put the public interest in the sense of not what interests the public, but in the sense of things the public need to know because they need to form a judgment about this person some particular way. Well, there with sex, it would be, in my opinion, very, very rare that the public have any need-to-know basis for their interest whatsoever.
The key element in terms of the consideration of the public interest in this case, of course, concerned the allegations that this was a Nazi-style orgy. And indeed, the judge said that, had he found evidence of that, then it may have been that the public interest, as it were, would have outweighed your right to privacy. But just take me through his consideration of the evidence on that point.
Well, what it all came down to was that there was nothing there that had any connection with Nazism. There were no symbols, no words, no gestures. The only Nazi thing in it was in the preliminaries of the tape the News of the World took, where the reporter was instructing the woman on how to take the film. He made it clear to her that he wanted her to get me to do a Sieghail. Now, in fact, she made no attempt to do that because it would have been so inappropriate. The whole thing, everybody would have suddenly stopped and looked at her as though she was mad if she'd started suggesting some sort of Nazi thing. Then, of course, my silk took the News of the World editor through all the pictures that had been taken and asked him for each one, can you point to anything in there that's remotely Nazi? And rounded it off by saying to him, well, Mr. Myler, this would have been the well-known Chelsea concentration camp with Officer Smith in charge. And it was just ludicrous, and I think the judge recognised that.
One of the things that I think will strike people as very curious about this whole case is that, in a way, you are adopting the moral high ground here. You're saying, really, Britain would be a better place if the press were better behaved, people had more protection in this area. On the other, this case centres around an activity which many people will find morally repugnant.
I think that's absolutely right. But you see, if you think back to, for example, when I was young, homosexuality was illegal. Gay people actually went to prison. And I think now people recognise that sex covers a huge spectrum, all the way from missionary position on a Saturday night with the lights out to the most way-out things that most of us wouldn't even think of or would find quite disgusting. Well, if it's consenting adults, if it doesn't involve, obviously, animals, children and things like that, and they're doing it in private, what is the problem? That's modern civilization. And here the continent is leading and these principles are well recognised on the continent. They're gradually coming over here, a little bit like homosexuality was legal on the continent for a very long time and gradually became legal here.
I put it to Ian Hislop that Max Mosley's got a point. There are some things, surely, like lawful, consensual sexual activity, whatever form it takes, that should absolutely be protected by a privacy law.
No, I don't think it is absolute. I think a lot of actions head into a grey area where they help you assess character in those who are either in public office or have official duties to perform. I mean, the problem about the Max Mosley case is it was the News of the World and the grey area was ludicrously muddied. But as a principle, no. I think he's extrapolating from one messy case into a much more absolute and much more dangerous privacy law.
He gives the example of, for instance, a school teacher who was a very good school teacher in a primary school. Everyone was delighted with her, the kids loved her, and it was revealed by her local paper that she was, in her spare time, was a dominatrix. And she didn't have the opportunity to do anything about it prior to publication. Once the story was published, her career was over, the kids were distraught, etc.
I don't think we are yet at the point where we have a Mosley-style consensus that all forms of sexual activity, including paid prostitution, are acceptable behaviour in your private life if you happen to hold some other position. So I don't think that can be done without fairly heavy further debate. And I would think, I mean, since Parliament is where we're meant to enact laws, that's where it should be done. If it is acceptable for a schoolteacher on the side to sell their services as a sadomasochistic prostitute, and that's acceptable to most parents in the country, then we should debate that and we should find out whether that's true. I doubt it myself, but, you know, maybe I'm just very old-fashioned.
So if you doubt it, that's a story that could be, should be published?
Again, that's an individual judgment. I mean, I wouldn't publish it because I'm not particularly interested in that and we don't do it. But, I mean, I can see there are papers that would say, well, yes, I mean, I think parents would be outraged and they don't want that.
So who should and who shouldn't enjoy the protection of this fast-developing privacy law? And when's it in the public interest to deny someone their privacy? As president of the International Automobile Federation, which governs Formula One, Max Mosley is a public figure running a private organisation. His family name has also put him into the public eye. I asked him where the parameters of the law should lie. For example, if someone stands for a certain set of values or holds themselves up as some kind of self-appointed moral guardian, isn't there a legitimate public interest in exposing them when they behave hypocritically?
For me, the question is, was the activity that is supposedly going to be revealed relevant to their public work? So, for example, if we have a transvestite who runs a huge company, he just goes into a little club in the evening with other transvestites, they all do it together. It does nothing of that in the headquarters of his company. To me, that is irrelevant. It's irrelevant to his job. Where it gets more difficult is if people or somebody puts forward a view which is completely inconsistent with his private behaviour and which is at the same time relevant to his public persona. And I think the relevance is the essential case because in the end the question is this something the public needs to know? Well, if they have to form a judgment about somebody, the public, they probably do need to know things which are relevant to his job. And of course, if he's then taking a moral position, then you can argue that some aspects, at least, of his morality are also relevant.
What about the new breed of celebrity that makes a living from effectively putting their private life into the public eye and spreads in Hello magazine and big checks from the newspapers? What position should they enjoy under this new regime of privacy?
Well, again, I think it's the question of relevance, because if they are taking a position saying, you know, we have a wonderful marriage and all the rest of it, and then perhaps they don't, well, then at a certain point, you might say, well, perhaps they shouldn't be trading on this and effectively taking money from the public for something which is not actually true. So I would say in that case, you could say it is relevant to their position. But if, for example, you've got two film stars and they are enjoying a nice sort of life as these celebrities do, and they're both bisexual, I don't think that concerns anybody.
One of the things that puzzled me since the inception of his case was why Max Mosley sued in privacy and not libel.
We have actually issued a writ for defamation. And the problem with defamation, from my point of view, was that would have taken forever to come on. So there would have been 2 or 3 years before it had come on, by which time everybody would have forgotten the damage was done. The thing about the privacy action was I was able, because the court agreed, to have an expedited trial, which meant I could actually get it on before the end of the summer term. And that, as the Nazi element, which is the one thing that I really objected to, as that was going to be an issue in the privacy trial, the obvious way to go was privacy, nail the Nazi lie, and then at leisure perhaps go after them for defamation, or even perhaps find a more efficient way of putting a stop to this sort of thing in the future.
So there will be a defamation action in this country?
We'll take a final decision when we know how things have gone on the continent, because, you see, we're suing for defamation in Germany, France and Italy. There are criminal proceedings attached to those actions in France and in Italy. And so, at the moment, I'm not in a great hurry to do anything in England, but I will keep it alive, wait and see what happens on the continent.
And tell me about the actions that you're taking across Europe. How quickly are those proceeding, and how quickly do you anticipate getting a result in any of those?
Well, they're a little bit like defamation actions here. They take quite a lot of time. But in Germany, in addition to my defamation action, there's a criminal prosecution of no fewer than 17 people connected with the Springer Verlag built and so on. In France, the matter's in the hands of the juge d'instruction. So that's a criminal proceeding against the editor and the reporter responsible of the News of the World, to which we attach a civil defamation action. So we're completely in the hands of the public authorities.
So it is possible that we could see more than two or three people, 17, 18 people, actually ending up in prison as a result of the actions you're taking?
It's theoretically possible. It's a matter now for the public prosecutor in Berlin, actually, and obviously then a matter for the courts. But theoretically it's possible, and theoretically it's possible that the editor and the chief reporter of the News of the World could go to prison in France.
Journalists in prison? That's serious. But how realistic is it? In Germany, the Nazi allegations make this case of particular interest. Roger Mann, a media lawyer in Hamburg, told me about the criminal charges, apart from defamation, which German journalists could face there.
There's another criminal offence called invasion of privacy by secret video recording or taking photos secretly. So these could be the criminal offences investigated by the German prosecution office.
And the fact that the taping, the filming took place in the UK, that doesn't make any difference?
That could make a difference because recording itself has to be illegal, and if the recording is not illegal under UK law, this also might result into the fact that it might not be illegal under German law.
How likely is it that the prosecutor will take forward the criminal defamation prosecution?
To be honest, it is not very likely, because on a daily basis there are criminal actions against journalists. And usually these criminal actions are settled out of court because German prosecution officers, probably just like the UK prosecutors as well, usually think that there are worthwhile things to do than to prosecute journalists for defamation.
Have any journalists in Germany been imprisoned for criminal defamation?
Not that I'm aware of.
So it's a crime on the statute books, but in practice it really is never prosecuted?
Exactly.
With the defamation case against the News of the World in the offing in the English courts, I asked media lawyer Amali De Silva how important the victory in the privacy action might prove to be.
It depends how he frames it, but it certainly helps having this privacy judgment in his favour, mostly because of the evidential findings that the judge made, the fact that the judge has already said that he didn't see any evidence of Nazi connections. That will certainly help.
Case closed, isn't it?
If that is the sole aspect of his defamation claim, you could say, yes, that would be case closed as far as liability is concerned, that it wasn't true. Then the next question would be, well, how much does he deserve for that? How much has his reputation been damaged, etc., etc.?
But the case that's really got the press quaking in their collective boots is the one Max Mosley is taking to the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg. He's seeking to establish a regime of prior notification. This is when a journalist has to advise the subject of a story what they intend to publish, and thus give the subject of the story the opportunity to seek an injunction preventing publication. That is seismic. Max Mosley again.
It would be a major change to our law, because the law has never been necessary in the past, because responsible journalists invariably put the case to the person they're accusing. If you're going to say somebody's done something bad, you tell him. I mean, if we take a recent example with the thing in the House of Lords about paying these peers, the Sunday Times has gone to each of them and asked them for their side of the story. And they would have then perfectly easily been able to go and ask for an injunction. I don't think they had the slightest chance of getting one, but they could have asked for one. What I'm saying is that in addition to being absolutely a basic duty of any proper journalist, it should now be a legal obligation, because unfortunately there are journalists who don't observe that convention. At the moment, you have a tabloid judge taking the decision as to whether he's going to ruin somebody's life. And I don't think he should be allowed to take that by himself. I think the victim should be entitled to go in front of a High Court judge and ask for this to be stopped. The High Court judge will only do that if there's a very strong case. In fact, the Human Rights Act requires him to be satisfied that there's a probability that you're going to win the privacy action. So there are tremendous safeguards for the papers. No responsible journalist would be in the least worried because he would do anyway what I'm seeking a law that he should do. It's just the dregs, the bottom end of the journalistic profession that would need this restraint.
If prior restraint is established under your case, but let's take an example of where a newspaper completely ignores it and publishes anyway, should there be a criminal sanction?
Well, in my opinion, there should. I think that it's not so much prior restraint, but prior notice. So the restraint would only come if you went to court and convinced a judge to restrain it. There should be prior notice because the only criticism that you see that's at all valid of the privacy laws and indeed the defamation laws is that it's very difficult for you to protect your rights if you're not wealthy. How many people have their lives ruined who are simply not in a position to defend themselves? They don't have the money to attack somebody like News of the World. Well, if there was a criminal sanction, they just go down to the police station. That's what happens on the continent, and I think we need a similar law here.
In Germany, journalists are already obliged to approach the subject of an investigation as part of the process of research, and then to include within their story any comment or denial the subject might make. That, it seems to me, is how Germany is currently balancing the right to privacy with the right to freedom of expression. But, says Roger Mann, prior notification and restraint would be quite different.
It would have an immense effect on the legal situation in Germany as it is right now. It is very limited, the possibilities to go to court prior to a publication and to obtain an injunction. But if there would be a new law saying that a person has to be notified of publication before the publication, and there would be legal remedies to stop the publication of the article at all, that would completely change the legal situation in Germany.
So would the German authorities be likely to approve such a change?
I don't think so, because it is, in my opinion, a violation of freedom of the press as guaranteed under Article 5 of the German Constitution.
Any decision in Mosley versus the UK would intensify the privacy debate across Europe. But in the UK, it would be far more serious. Amalie De Silva doesn't support any change to the law here. There are, she says, many circumstances where journalists must have the right to publish.
If somebody is trying to filibuster a really important story, something which may have an impact on a criminal investigation, you know, may lead to the destruction of evidence. I mean, I'm talking here in more general terms rather than the specifics of Mr. Mosley's case. But there are circumstances where it may well not be appropriate to go to a subject before the story is actually published, because he may be able to impede the course of justice or many other situations like compromise national security, whatever the case may be.
Well, that's where you need a robust judge, isn't it, to adjudicate between the two parties. And in some circumstances, he'll say, well, yes, you know, I'm going to give you your injunction because it's a just case. Yeah. In other circumstances, he's going to say, no, freedom of expression trumps all, as it were.
Well, the thing about freedom of expression and the right to a private life is that they are both fundamental rights. And the European Convention on Human Rights does not give precedence to one or the other. And there is a balancing act to be carried out. Now, the question is, at what stage should that be carried out and by whom? And the fact is that if you are asking a judge to make a ruling on a very preliminary basis, which is essentially what an injunction application is, the judge doesn't have a great deal of information in front of him. Whether or not that is the right situation in which to curtail freedom of speech in its entirety in all cases is a serious issue.
But Max Mosley has little patience with the argument that prior notification would impede the press in its mission to uncover wrongdoing.
I think you'd find that if somebody wanted to get an injunction to stop issues like the recent thing of the House of Lords or the exposure of documents which are clearly of interest to the public in the sense that they should know about them, I don't think the judge would ever give an injunction to stop that. And then the privacy action, people can bring a privacy action, they wouldn't win it. The standards are pretty high, and you can't be certain you'll ever win a privacy action when you've got a good case. But in those cases, I really don't think that will happen. What it is the newspaper, a certain kind of newspaper, raises the spectre of not being able to do proper investigative journalism to confuse the issue. And the reality is that they would never be stopped from doing things of that kind.
Well, I think that's not true. I don't share his faith. Injunctions are being handed out like confetti as we speak. It seems to me nowadays, if you want to toddle along and see a master and say, I've got a story, it's private, I don't want it in, out comes the order. I mean, they're all over Fleet Street. So, no, I don't share his view. And also, in my experience, he may be confident because the judges are likely to side with him. On the whole, they're not very thrilled by the press. You know, and I suppose if you read the News of the World, you can see why. But that is one of the problems about a free press. It's not very pretty, but it is free.
Private Eye editor Ian Hislop. If Max Mosley wins his case in Strasbourg, the British government will be obliged to implement the ruling in the UK. So will that inevitably force the government to legislate? Amalie de Silva again.
They may well do. And in fact, Jack Straw's already announced that there's going to be a review of privacy law. I have to say, I don't envy anybody who has to draft the privacy legislation.
Yeah, these are sort of tectonic plates, really, aren't they? The right to privacy on the one hand, the right to freedom of expression on the other. How do you draft a law that copes with those two plates, if you like, keeps them sort of reasonably balanced and actually provides protection for people's private lives?
That's the trick, really. I mean, it's very difficult when you're trying to legislate for very broad principles. It's always much, much more difficult than if you're trying to deal with just one specific eventuality, because there are so many things that you have to try and consider. You're never going to be able to take into account every single factual scenario. And that is really where the danger lies, I think, when you are trying to legislate.
Amalie de Silva. Well, the two opposing views on privacy and press freedom couldn't have been put more squarely than by Max Mosley on the one hand and Ian Hislop on the other. How free do we want our press to be? And how much privacy protection do we want to give our public figures and ourselves? We'd like you to exercise your right to freedom of expression and tell us where you stand in the debate. You can tap and click your thoughts to us at bbc.co.uk/lawinaction.